We were discussing last time the elements of a true sacrifice. We also discussed to whom the sacrifice is to be offered. To continue our discussion, it is understood that progress in the path of sacrifice, and by sacrifice we mean in our consecration, the progress lies in two directions. First, growth in our nature of something that corresponds in however smaller measure to the ideal which we seek, and the revelation or the experience of the divine in our inner experience. How far our nature is progressing is to be determined by each individual. It is a common question that I have met with so often. How do we know that we progress? And there is only one answer. If we are frank to ourselves, if we have the courage to face the truth, there is only one barometer. How do I react to men and things in day-to-day life? Is my reaction to events, to happenings, to people the same as it was before I took up yoga? That is the simple question. If I react to anger, to jealousy on the part of one whom I meet, with the same vibrations, vibrations of resentment, vibrations of anger, then certainly I am no better than he is. If, on the other hand, I feel a certain control, I do not respond to his vibrations, but can detach myself and keep myself unaffected, that is one step gained. It is in this way, in our reactions to day-to-day events, our thoughts, our feelings, our actions, through that we can measure whether our nature is changing or not, whether we are progressing or not. The second part is our experience of the divine. The divine that we seek, Sri Aurobindo points out, is not a monolithic reality. It is an infinite. It is multitudinous in its manifestations. And the seeker of the integral reality has to keep himself open to an integral revelation. The revelation may come in one form or more forms, simultaneously or successively. But the most important and the basic realization that should form the foundation for other realizations is the perception that behind all the fleeting phenomena of life, the changing forms and movements, there is something permanent, there is something eternal. Behind the turnings in time, there is an eternal that upholds the revolutions of time. Behind all the movements in the cosmos, there is something which upbears the universe. This perception and awakening to the existence of a self, a reality, an irreducible reality, a reality that does not pass, but which holds in its palms all that passes, that is the basic reality which we must at least mentally conceive, imagine, and link ourselves with. Once we establish the reality of this eternal being, eternal presence in the universe, in our consciousness, there is a movement of liberation. We no more belong to the transient phenomena. Something of us is poised, has taken its poise in what is eternal, in what is basic. That done, the first realization and the easiest is to become aware of the divine presence within oneself. It is asked very often by scoffers, the divine is everywhere. Of the same self beating in the hearts of others, you meet the others in the same self. This is the truth of Mother's saying that you can arrive at unity with others only at the soul level. Unity with others at any other level, the emotional, the mental, the verbal, is an artificial unity. But if we touch the level of the soul, the self, which is extended in all, there you touch the point where you are one with others. To become aware of the divine presence within oneself, the presence not apart from the universe, but as dwelling in the universe, that is one realization. The second, particularly for those who are very extrovert, outward given in their makeup, is the perception of the divine in others, outside themselves, in the world, in any form. This also is a mighty experience. When every form that passes before your eyes becomes a window opening on the divine presence in the universe. And this is not all. You can awake to the divine within yourself. You can be aware and respond to the divine outside yourself in the universe. But there is also a third realization which is open to the individual, which may very well press upon the seeker, that is the existence of a reality which is not bound within the formula of the cosmos. It exceeds both the individual and the universe. Seen from that poise of transcendence, the whole universe looks like a speck. An individual is a point. The whole movement looks like a petty swarm. But Sri Aurobindo points out, this transcendent reality also is not to be looked upon as something divorced from the cosmos, but as something that supports it, something that projects it, and yet it is outside its bounds. These are the three major realizations that are open to the seeker of integral yoga once he launches himself on the path of sacrifice. But in the course of the experience, there are again gradations, there are again lines of experience of the divinity. On one line, you are conscious of a divine being, a divine presence in yourself, around you in the universe, which is not affected, which is eternal, which is ineffable, which is irreducible. But at the same time, you see that in the universe, things are subject to time, things are subject to limitation, things are not permanent, things are passing. There is a constant movement, and that movement is executed by a force, by an energy, by a power, which imposes the whole universe on your consciousness concretely. This some of the thinkers and the seers have called the power of Maya, of erecting a whole universe of appearances, of forms and names on the pure being of Brahman. So the appearance, in appearance, and in a concrete way, the experience impinges upon some, where the whole universe looks like a cheat, like an illusory phenomenon foisted on the pure white being of Brahman. This duality of Brahman and Maya is the first to greet the spiritual seeker in his path. But the true seeker does not stop at appearances. He goes deeper and finds that Maya is not merely a power that veils, but it is also a power that creates. It is a power that veils. It is equally a power that liberates. It does not derive its power of creation from itself. It is a working of the will of Brahman, of the will of the reality, the person creative in execution. If it appears to veil, it is because its processes are worked out in the field of ignorance. Once the seeker recognizes that it is a field of ignorance and looks up to the heights of knowledge, the same power of Maya works to liberate him from the hold of ignorance. So the deceptive appearance of Brahman and Maya as the sole creator and the power of illusion yields to the perception that the whole universe, the whole creation, is a projection of Brahman through his own creative power, which the ancients called Maya, because Maya in classical Sanskrit, in the older Sanskrit, meant something that measures in a cunning way. The divine reality is immeasurable. If a measurable universe is brought out of what is immeasurable, it is due to the existence of a power that has it within its working, within its cunning working, to project a finite out of a source that is infinite. Another experience that the seeker comes across is, he feels within himself, a part, one part that is aloof when he meditates, when he muses, when he is quiet. He feels a being within himself, a central being that just witnesses. He does not take part in the movement that goes on. The deeper he digs into that what is called the witness consciousness, he knows that there is a strong individualized conscious center, a Purusha, who observes. Then if he observes, what does he observe? He observes a movement that is being worked out by an active energy. That energy is called Prakriti, nature. So here again there is the dichotomy of soul and nature, of Purusha and Prakriti. If you take your stand in the witness consciousness, you are aloof, you are not involved, you are liberated to that extent. If you lose yourself in the revolutions of nature, of Prakriti, you are a slave to nature. You see that you are bound and there is no escape. But if you persist in going deeper, you will see that nature works, nature moves to present the experience to the soul. The soul regards, and in the very regard bestowed upon nature, there is the assent, there is the consent. Once you arrive at this perception, it is easy to step from this poise of slavery to the poise of the master of nature by identifying yourself with the witness soul, which reveals itself to be a master soul. At another level, it is possible to impose your will on nature. This is the second experience or realization, the Purusha and the Prakriti, in soul and nature. Third comes at a much later stage, is the consciousness of a divine soul within yourself, the divine Godhead seated in your being, governing the whole manifestation. And nature power, which is no more ignorant, but illumined, the Shakti. And the Shakti reveals itself to be none else but the active conscious force of the Godhead, the Ishvara and the Shakti. What began as Brahman and Maya, what pursued as Purusha and Prakriti, culminates in the experience of the Ishvara and the Shakti. As in the experience of Purusha and Prakriti, it is possible for the seeker to dwell more in one poise and derive its full rich experience. There have been seers who have dwelt more in the poise of Ishvara and looked upon the Shakti, the creative puissance, as something subordinate and have developed philosophies accordingly. There have been equally other seers who have taken their stand on the pedestal of the Shakti, the puissance, and have regarded the Lord as a passive witness, as in effect, though not in theory, subordinate to the Shakti. Now these three reflect a fundamental principle in creation, the principle of polarity. The divine reality is indeed one, unique, alone, when it is by itself. But when it chooses to manifest, when it chooses to bring out something within itself, it takes a double position, a biune position, which in the Indian tradition has been expressively called the male and the female principles. He and she. At all levels of creation, this dual principle is there, whether it is patent or latent. And even in spiritual life, this principle of duality comes into operation at the level of manifestation. There has been a good deal of misunderstanding on the subject, particularly in the Western quarters. I have seen scores of letters, read scores of books, talked to so many people who are under the delusion that every spiritual seeker must have a shakti to arrive at fulfillment. This is an error, and thrice an error. A shakti, a creative puissance, an instrument is required only when the stage for manifestation arrives. And that stage for the manifestation of the divine glory is far, far off for 99% of the seekers. One has to first develop the consciousness. One has to traverse the long way before one is in a position of something to manifest. Till one arrives at a radical conversion of consciousness, if one believes that one has something to manifest, it is sheer egoism. Egoity is not true. There is no necessity of either a Shakti or a Radha for a seeker. And there is another truth, another occult truth, which everyone must remember, that in every individual, whether he is a man or a woman, this principle of polarity is instinct. In each man, there is a part that is feminine. In each woman, there is a part that is masculine. It is possible to so arrange the workings of the twin principles in oneself that no outer instrument is necessary for manifestation. This point also must be borne in mind. Once the seeker is open to these varied experiences, to these varied revelations of the divine, he ceases to be narrow-minded. He can only smile at the charges of polytheism, monotheism by missionaries and propagators of philosophies and religions. All are true. But in a certain line of experience, the uniqueness, the oneness of God is preponderant. At another level, the same one manifests himself in a myriad figures, in a myriad forms, allows himself to be approached through so many gonads. That also is true. The divine manifests himself not merely through so many gods and goddesses, through so many deities, but through all the million forms that are on the move that are not even on the move in the universe. And an awakened seeker, an awakened yogin, regards the divine in the smallest plant, in the smallest insect. This is the way, and the goal, the result, is union with the divine, which again can be of diverse kinds. The one kind of union which is most common to spiritual experience is union in the deepest self with the divine by identity. I reach my soul level, the self, and from there identify myself with the reality that is divine. That is, in a sense, I am united with the divine. This is called union by identity. It is attainment. There is another kind of realization, that is, the whole of my being, not only the core, it dwells in its consciousness, in the larger consciousness of the divine. It always feels the divine presence close, near. In a way, it dwells in the world of the divine. This indwelling in the realm of the divine is another type of realization, another type of union. The first one of identity is common in the way of knowledge. One of living, of dwelling close to the divine, breathing his air, is common in the way of love. But there is a third, by training, by discipline, by repeated consecration and orientation, the human nature grows and puts on the higher nature, the nature of the divine. It bears resemblance. It has the same vibrations, same character as the divine nature. This is called similarity of likeness of nature. This is the rapid result of the yoga of works sincerely pursued. Thus, with all these realizations to be worked out, with all these types of unions to be effected, it goes without saying that it is not one part of the individual that does, that progresses, that merges in the divine, but there is an ascent of the whole being towards the divine. The whole, the mind, the soul, the heart, the vital force, the emotions, the body, and what is below, the whole of it is lifted. And the way proceeds not merely through ascents. There is not one ascent, but as the Vedic seer pointed out, one goes plateau by plateau. Each plateau flings around you the much more that is to be done, the large area that is still to be trodden. Each height reveals a new horizon. There are peaks after peaks that have to be ascended. But this is not a one-way traffic. Sri Aurobindo points out that a conscientious seeker, each step that he takes forward, each step that he scales, he has to descend back with that gain. Relate that new gain to the rest of the being that has not yet participated in that victory. Integrate that gain with the rest of the being. So a series of ascents is a parallel series of descents. Alone can work out transformation of nature. And when this difficult process is pursued, one has to fight, not merely with the resistances, with the enemies within one's own being, but has to take account of the enemies outside the universal forces of resistance and ignorance, which are not to yield the area under the dominion for ages. All kinds of resistances, individual and universal, have to be conquered, fought. No human individual, however strong, can hope to do it unaided. And that is where the call of surrender, one surrenders oneself to the higher yoga force, the divine mother force that is active, that oversees the whole spiritual endeavor of man, and delivers oneself into her hand. Then the link, the effective link between the individual here and the divine power, the divine Shakti that works from above, is in the emergence of what is called the psychic being within oneself. Loosely, it is called the soul in philosophy. There is a great deal of difference between what is called soul and the psychic, but that we shall take for another subject, another day. But with the emergence of the psychic being from behind the veil, half the battle is won. Because the divine obtains a strong foothold to function in external nature, to obviate the difficulties posed by the lower nature. Till then, the ascent of the mind, the ascent of the vital, all these are necessary. But once the psychic being emerges in the front, a strong foothold is gained and the path becomes rapid. And the path becomes rapid. Speaking of the psychic being, here is a question. Sri Aurobindo says, the mental Purusha is witness, but not controller and lord of nature. It is only when we rise to the Vijnanamaya Purusha that the true lordship prevails. Is the psychic a witness consciousness or a true lord of nature or something else? Well, it is a very intelligent question. The psychic is not the lord of nature. Psychic is a presence. It acts, it guides when it is consulted. Otherwise, it stays as a witness. It may prompt to a nature which is accustomed to be guided by psychic. By the psychic, even when he does not seek its guidance, it may prompt from behind. But if its promptings are ignored once, twice, thrice, thereafter it falls silent. The psychic is not normally an active element that imposes itself. It is a silent presence of the divine which responds to our call. It also depends upon the development of the psychic element. There is the psychic essence, the psychic element, the psychic entity, the psychic being. These are various stages of the growth of the psychic presence. When the psychic is a fully developed personality and a being, that is a different question. But among most of the seekers, the psychic is a silent presence which waits to be consulted, which waits to be approached. Due to the pressure of its instruments, the psychic often must submit to mistakes of action. Well, you would have known by now, after what I have said, that the psychic does not impose itself. It may put out its guidance, which is immediately seized upon by the hungering vital by the interested ego and perverted. Even then, the psychic warns with a sense of uneasiness in the pit of the stomach, in the center of the heart, some unexplained uneasiness. But if ignored, it again withdraws. The psychic does not interfere. Psychic is not the truth consciousness. It is, you may say, a delegate in evolution of the truth being above. It is a growing presence, growing in the rounds of evolution, adding to its stature day by day. That is what is called the psychic being in evolution, is called the soul. Another question which I should have touched upon earlier while speaking of the difficulties within oneself to the transformation of nature. There is a good deal of misunderstanding among psychologists dating from the days of Jung, Adler, and their Indian followers, that it is wrong to suppress movements like sex, that it upsets the system, it throws one into unnatural movements and impedes natural development of the soul. But it is only a half truth. Suppression of sex is wrong only, is harmful only if there is a physical suppression but a mental indulgence. Cessation from the physical act of sex itself is not at all harmful. On the other hand, there is quite a philosophy which it will take me another 15 minutes, which I don't propose to launch upon now. It is very healthy. It develops the individual potential for transformation. But apart from all that, if the mind consents to that denial, if the mind supports and does not indulge in any kind of movement, maybe greed for food, power, whatever it is, the first movement is always of pressing it down, holding it down, suppression. Once one gets a sufficient control by suppression, then the question of rejection becomes very easy. Rejection is the aim. Rejection is three-fourths of the path in this context, but one necessarily starts with suppression. Before ending, instead of the usual anecdote, I have thought it fit to read out one or two papers which I think reflect some kind of spiritual revolution on the part of the individual who has written it. It had a great impact on the persons who heard it, and it occurred to me when I was reading them to Mother that I should share them with you all, my dear friends. Necessarily, no names are revealed, no clues are given, but it concerns a young, talented seeker, less than 30, who arrived here in pursuit of his quest under mysterious circumstances, and who wrote to Mother that he wished very much to converse with her, to write to her, but that his head was so full of so many things, thoughts, currents, that he could not express himself. He asked, "Mother, perhaps if you ask me a question, I could express myself." I didn't seriously expect Mother to take note of this question. But when she was listening to the letter, she suddenly opened her eyes and she said, "Take down the question." I was very pleasantly surprised. I took down the question, gave it to the individual. Naturally, he was happy. And almost the next day he was back with his reply, which I would like to read to you. He writes, "Here in the ashram, one beautiful day is followed by an even more beautiful one. I am happy to be working in a society that wants something more than matter and machines. I have many things to tell you, but it is hard for me to put what I think into words. If you asked me a question, I would find it easier. I hope my request will not interrupt your peace. I always see the light of your skin and the brightness of your eyes. Your eternal servant." The question Mother wrote, "Do you believe in a progressive world?" Answer: "I have received your much desired question, to which I now give the answer. Yes, I believe in the progress of the world, in spite of the many men who are determined to detain it. The light, the flame of the new consciousness that Sri Aurobindo announced and you have brought, advances with certain and firm steps. No human can detain something which is beyond his simple earthly consciousness. A new morning is dawning, and in a day not far off, all men on earth will recognize the Father and the Mother of the universe incarnate in an Indian man that is the most spiritual, intelligent and wise man on earth, and in a white woman of the youngest race, which as youngest leaped into space. Now, after a natural inexperience, we can begin to count on a youth that wants no more lies from neurotic politicians and from a psychotic society. Now they want the truth. I hope that in a day not far off, like me, all the youth of the world, of all races, religions, ideas and forms, come to pay homage to the only truth, the eternal truth, you and Sri Aurobindo, Mother and Father of us all, God. I await your answer, and please, another question. Writing to you makes me feel well, and now it is easier. Your eternal servant." Mother wrote, "It is very good. You are welcome here. Blessing." Then the next question: "Do you believe that the next step in evolution is the appearance of a supramental race? Do you aspire to belong to the supramental race?" We'll take up the answer at our next meet. Before